Good afternoon. I'd like to call the House Labor and Commerce Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, January 24th, 2024. Let the record reflect the time is 3:17 p.m. Today we have present Representative Sadler, Representative Prox, Representative Wright, Representative Carrick, Representative Fields, Vice Chair Ruffridge, and myself, Chair Sumner. The staff that will be assisting us today are Cheryl Cole with House Records, Zachary Lawhorn with the LIO, and Clark Bickford, my staff and committee aide for House Labor and Commerce. Today in committee, we have three items on the agenda. We'll start with a special presentation on workforce solutions for Alaska from Dr. Denise Rungi. Sorry if I mispronounced that. Provost of the University of Alaska Anchorage. And we'll take a brief at ease while we get ready for that. So. Okay, we are back on the record. So starting with the presentation on workforce solutions for Alaska, I'd like to invite Dr. Denise Rungi to please come forward and put your name on the record and begin. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Sumner. For the record, my name is Denise Rungi. I'm the provost and academic vice chancellor at the University of Alaska Anchorage. Thank you so much for the opportunity to talk to you about one of the most important needs facing our state, and that is workforce, and doing whatever we can to keep folks staying in Alaska to keep our workforce strong. And I want to share with you that University of Alaska Anchorage and our other two universities, the University of Alaska Fairbanks and the University of Alaska Southeast, we are all committed to working together to make sure that we can do everything possible to meet these needs. So we're going to focus on UAA today, but I assure you, you know, we work closely with the other two institutions, and we're happy to do what we can to get information for you from them as well. UAA is actually Alaska's largest workforce training and education provider. We have been serving Alaska for 70 years. We're a comprehensive, open access university. In other words, if you have a GED or if you've graduated from high school, you are eligible, and we would love to have you at UAA, no matter your age, no matter your background. We enroll currently about 11,500 students. I say about because classes just started, and we're still adding students, and so we'll have a final number that looks a little different. We prepare students for careers in over 180 separate kinds of programs, all the way from short-term certificates up through a couple of doctorates. We are what is called a dual mission university. And there aren't a lot of states that use this model. Alaska's one of the first. In fact, all the way back in the 1980s, our community colleges, as you may remember, were merged with the university system. And so what that means is UAA combines both missions into one institution. We are your community college and we are your university. We're a leader in career and tech education. That's going to be the focus of our talk today. We have industry-driven programs and partnerships, and we really are interested in continuing to partner in the community and have an impact beyond just the learning of our students, but all the things that they can do for the communities that we serve through their service learning, their projects, and, of course, all of the things that research can do to answer the tough questions for Alaska. So today I'm joined online by a couple of our university's leaders who are going to join in and speak about their specific areas of expertise. And through the chair, if I may, I'd like to invite in Dean Ray Weber.
Yes, please. Thank you.
Hello. For the record, my name is Raymond Weber, Dean of the Community and Technical College at University of Alaska, Anchorage. Can everybody hear me okay?
We can hear you.
Excellent. So my college has the opportunity to do a lot of number of different individual workforce programs, but some of our highlights and high demand industries include aviation. We have 4 aviation programs, with one of them being piloting. We happen to be one of Alaska's largest flight training programs, and we are the only one at this time that has a restricted ATP authorization. So graduates of our programs can start working for airlines as soon as a year sooner than a person off the street. We have specialized programs that include aviation management, but all of our programs work to focus on skill sets that are asked for from the airlines and local operators. At this time, the program is actually full, thanks to the support of state and local donors and the like. We have actually been able to fill the program. Aviation maintenance is another one. With the aging workforce in aviation maintenance, this program also has a significant draw and a number of students. The program itself happens to be full and is looking for ways to expand. Again, expanding programs are great. The graduates are sought after not just for aviation maintenance, but several of them are working for aerospace companies and different governmental groups, including NASA. Air traffic control is a unique program up here. We are one of 29 programs in the country specifically designed to prepare students for careers in air traffic control through what is known as the FAA Collegiate Training Initiative. We have state-of-the-art facilities, and we have some of the highest pass rates at the Oklahoma City training grounds for the FAA. It's quite impressive. However, moving on to the next program, we have a set of construction management programs, an associate's and a bachelor's. We're one of the few bachelor's programs that is fully online and available to people across the country, though it is primarily taken by students here in Alaska. And it is showing consistent growth now. It has a focus on Arctic and cold weather construction, which is a unique and often sought out set of knowledge and capabilities. By having this bachelor's degree, I'm already thinking of the next statement, it allows companies that have these graduates to bid federal jobs. They have the certification when they graduate to do so. But also, this program leads into a master's of program management, currently taught at UAA's College of Engineering. Moving on to the next group, we have both an automotive and a diesel program. They're integrated, so there is a lot of crossover, but both programs have different focuses, and it provides industry training. Both are ASE certified and accredited. They have all their students take practicum experience out in the field. They come back with capabilities, and we have a significant amount of training that works with partnerships with General Motors, Caterpillar, and really any of the dealerships throughout Alaska. At this time, we're also doing several non-credit trainings associated with electrical for Kendall Ford and a few other different organizations. And last but not least, moving on to culinary arts, which is where I love to have my meetings so that I can get what is left over. The culinary arts program is the largest in the state, and it has served the state for over 50 years now. They are accredited by the American Culinary Federation, and that allows our students to be tested and, after industry experience, become fully certified chefs when they leave their culinarians, which is also a step in certification. They run a restaurant. So they get both front and back of house experience where they actually act as the chef, the pastry chef, and then they're going to have to run the front end of the restaurant as well, acting as servers, managers, hostess. So this experience has provides them real world experience and preparation to go out in the industry. And it will be very difficult to find areas in the culinary arts throughout the state where we don't have a graduate. We're also developing a collaboration with J-Bear to help them train up culinarians for their operations on base and coordinate additional training as necessary. So that would be at least the CTC. I believe Dean Craig is next.
Do we have questions during the process?
We can, yeah. Representative Fields. Thank you, through the chair. I know that, you know, in Southeast Alaska, the mining industry sponsors training for people who go to work for Hecla or Hecla Greens Creek or Kensington. Do your employers for whom you're providing specific training, such as you mentioned Kendall, are they sponsoring or otherwise supporting any of this training, or is that cost fully borne by the students in the state?
This one is actually being paid for by the companies themselves. So at this time, we have been asked by certain dealerships to provide the training, and they pay for their employees. We have had several people that were not paid for pay for themselves to take those classes when we have an open spot. We don't close it off to anybody in the public, but a lot of the training has been sponsored by the individual dealerships in this case.
Thanks. Can I ask a follow-up? Thanks to the chair. I had a question on the economics of receiving culinary training. I assume that students are paying for this training, and what is the cost of the training for students, and just based on the labor market in, say, Anchorage today, how long does it take for students to both survive and pay back the loans for those programs? Thank you.
I'll remember this time. Through the chair, I'd be happy to provide some further details, but I can talk a little bit about it. Most of our students are able to move out and into the industry almost immediately after graduation. And we have 2 1-year programs and a 2-year associates. This happens to be one of the programs that has some of the most scholarship funds available, as industry has supported these. So I do not have the specific payback time off the top of my head. We'll have to get that back to you. That being said, we've been able to support a number of students and minimize the cost through those scholarships and coordination with industry.
Thank you. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, Mr. Webb, if you'll refer to the slide 6 on construction, the last point says that program graduation qualifies graduates to bid for federal projects. To my understanding, doesn't somebody have to have a contractor license, or does actually this program lead to a contractor license which qualifies them to bid on federal projects, or is it special set aside, or help me understand?
Through the chair.
Right on.
I can get you the specific certifications that they get throughout, but the contractor's license is part of the program setup. To the best of my knowledge, it is not a required exam that they take as part of one of the courses, but I would have to verify that. Mm-hmm. Did that answer your question?
Through the chair, not exactly. So, graduates can immediately bid on federal projects. Has that happened at all? Is there any history of people graduating and then going on to bid for federal projects, contracts? And that seems to be a great leap forward rather quickly.
Through the chair, that is an excellent question. I do not have the answer, but I'll be happy to see if we can find out that specific one.
All right, well, that's great. Thanks.
Can I ask a question?
Representative.
Thank you, through the chair. I also am curious about the construction training program. So does the typical participant kind of come out of the field after completing an apprenticeship? Is the typical participant going straight to college out of high school and then trying to work at a desk job in a construction company? Or
kind of what who is entering this training, and then what do they do afterwards, other than it sounds like maybe being an estimator? Thank you.
Through the chair, in this particular case, that program set has the widest range that I have seen. I would say about a third of it are people coming out of the field, generally from the trades, working to get promoted in the company. About a third of them are people that have worked in the construction industry but weren't necessarily trades. So estimators, but they wanted to complete their education, or people that have utilized, and I apologize, I'm drawing a blank, but and I can even see the career path. But basically, the ones you were talking about that were working at the desk, they wanted to expand their education. And then about a third of it is 18 to 19-year-olds looking to work towards the construction management option. One of the things I can say about that specific program is there's a lot of interaction and coordination with our advisory board, which unto itself acts as internships. Each of the students get an internship, and they end up working in the field one way or another. We have waived that for people that have come back with experience, of course. So if they're coming back, they've worked in the field. But in the particular case of this, it is a very wide range of students. There, I'd like to be able to pinpoint one, but that is probably our most blended.
Thank you.
Did that answer your question?
Yes.
Representative Wright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, I don't really have a question, more of a statement. I just wanted to thank Dean Weber for all the hard work and efforts you put into this. And I've actually had the opportunity to work with one of the graduates from the automotive program. And this young man was very young, and he knew exactly what he was doing. He helped me build a couple engines, and it's outstanding. I really appreciate it. He had the confidence and the ability to do so. So thank you. I think the program is thriving, and he was really happy with what he learned. So I really do appreciate you. Go see Wolves.
Through the chair, if I may. If we're ready, I'd be happy to now bring in our College of Health Dean, Debbie Craig, to talk about another very important workforce area that we help.
Yes, please. Thank you.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Debbie Craig, and I'm the Dean for the College of Health at the University of Alaska Anchorage. Alaska Anchorage University has been designated by the Board of Regents as the flagship health university for the state, and the College of Health is where most of those programs are housed, as you can guess. We have more than 40 health degree programs, ranging from occupational endorsement certificates, such as a OEC in child behavioral health. We have AS degrees, such as diagnostic medical sonography or radiology technology. We have many bachelor's degrees, as in human services or health sciences, or a bachelor's degree in dental hygiene, to give you a little variety. And we have several master's degrees. Our master's in public health is an all-online program, as is our master's in social work. You'll hear me talk about social work in a bit. And then we have a couple of doctoral degrees also. We have our WAMI medical program that offers a medical doctorate. We have our doctorate in nursing practice, or a DNP program. And we have our PharmD, which is a clinical doctorate in pharmacology that's offered in partnership with Idaho State. So we have quite an array of health programs to offer the state and work on that workforce edge. We can't do all of that without really close partnerships with all of the providers that provide oversight or supervision for the clinical rotations that our students go through in all of our health programs. We have health industry partners that support us both with facilities and people and funding at times all across the state. And then policymakers like all of you that are so critical to our mission. So thank you for being supportive of the College of Health and all the things that we're trying to do to for workforce need in the health communities. We have hundreds of graduates each year. When we go to graduation, my hand gets a little tired with shaking all of our graduates' hands, and that's a good problem to have. So our nursing program is probably at the forefront of that, with graduating over 200 nurses annually. We offer the nursing program at 15 locations around the state, all the way from Kotzebue, Bethel, Dillingham, Nome, Kodiak, three places across the Kenai Peninsula, down in Juneau, around where you all are at, with Ketchikan and Sitka also, and then Valdez and Fairbanks and the Mat-Su Valley also. So it's quite a range of nursing programs around the state, and that is unique to Alaska, which is something we're very proud of. Next slide, please. So when we talk about growing Alaska's healthcare workforce, I wanted to highlight four of our programs that are front and center for us because of the shortage in the state. Our medical doctor program is the WAMI program. You've probably heard of that. WAMI stands for Washington, Wyoming, Alaska, Montana, and Idaho. It is run by the University of Washington, and they've been a really great partner for us over the years. We're increasing the cohort size from 20 to 30 students per cohort, and we've already started that this last summer with taking in our first five step-ups. So we started 25 medical students this past summer, I'm thrilled to say. And our medical assisting program, we're designing a statewide program that's in the early stages right now. Medical assisting, if you're not aware, has five different levels of certification, and we're the only program university or educational institution in the state that offers the highest degree level. So our graduates are extremely sought after everywhere across the state, and we are working on some marketing campaigns to increase our student output with that, or enrollment, really. So they're very sought after in every angle of healthcare in the state. Dental hygiene is a bachelor's degree here, and we're increasing that cohort from 14 to 20. Most all of our health programs are accredited with a specialized accreditor, and right now we're waiting on that accreditor to give us approval to pump up to the 20. We have everything else ready to go for that. And then lastly, our social work program, our Master's of Social Work program, received a grant through Recover Alaska that had several different funders in that, and so we had multiple partners that contributed to that, and that is allowing us to grow from 35 students per cohort to 85 students per cohort over the next 4 or 5 years. We've already we received that funding in the spring of last year and started 55 students in the summer, so it was quite a big jump just with a few months warning. We were able to get that moving, so we were thrilled about that. And next slide. And my last slide here, we can't do all of this. We cannot address all of the healthcare workforce needs in the state without really innovative partnership programs that we have. WAMI is the most well-known of those partnership programs, and that's with the University of Washington. We have our physician assistant program, which is called the MedX program, and that is also in partnership with the University of Washington. Our pharmacy doctorate program is a partnership with Idaho State University. They've been fantastic to work with. And then our speech-language pathology program is a master's program in partnership with East Carolina University. And lastly, our occupational therapy doctorate program is in partnership with Creighton University. And that is what I have for you. Thank you.
I think we had Representative Carrick. And then Representative Fields.
Thank you, through the chair. I'll start by reminding Representative Wright over there to be careful about the territory here. At the same time, I am one of your graduates from the College of Health at UAA, so thank you. Yay. To Dean Craig. So I admit those credentials. I had a question about the nursing program. We have a one-pager here for us. It says School of Nursing admits an average of 200 nursing students per year, and that over 95% of the graduates seek licensure in Alaska. So the two pieces of information I would like to get at some point. If you don't have it today, that's okay. How many nursing graduates do we have from the School of Nursing at UAA? And also, do we have statistics on how many of our UAA nursing graduates end up working in Alaska? We know 95% seek licensure. How many end up achieving licensure and working in Alaska?
Yeah, through the chair, thank you. And thank you for being a graduate of our university and our college. We love to hear that. So we have, last year we graduated 198 students in the May session, and then another big handful, 60-something, I believe, in the December graduation, and that was for last year. When we talk about two different graduation times, that's why we give a roughly somewhere over 200 per year. So that is what we're most excited about. We have, of those 95% that seek licensure in the state, there have only been a couple that I've heard of that did not attain licensure from our program. And whether they actually work in the state, we've made the assumption that if they're seeking licensure here, they are then seeking employment here. Most of our graduates have jobs before they, or job offers at least, before they leave the university, usually through their clinical connections.
Representative Fields?
Thank you, through the chair. You mentioned the medical assisting program. I know that the Alaska Primary Care Association is working with the Hospital Association to expand register apprenticeships and medical assisting, and when you are starting up or expanding kind of a traditional classroom model of medical assisting, what kind of analysis do you do to see should you be providing didactic instruction to an existing employer-sponsored program? Do you help expand the employer-sponsored program? Or if you establish a traditional classroom model, how do you do that in a way that best complements a growing employer-sponsored program? Thank you.
Yes, through the chair. Thank you, Representative Fields. That's no small question, but I think I can get to an answer for you. We work very closely with Nancy Merriman, and Nancy, of course, is running that apprenticeship program for the Alaska Primary Care Association. And so we have a really great partnership with her, and we have followed her lead. So she has asked us to not essentially kind of insert ourselves. And I said, no problem. I'm at the ready. We're at the ready. When you would like us to help at all with that, we've got our own stuff going on, but we're really happy to help in any way that we can. And so that is an easy partnership, and Nancy is really wonderful to work with. So we're excited about that. And again, the need for MAs in the state is so big. We are happy to help, and anybody that comes to us with a request to offer the didactic part of it or anything else, clinical partnerships, whatever we can do, we're happy to help. Did that answer your question, Representative Fields?
Yes, through the chair, that's a great answer. And if I might ask a question on nursing,
you bet.
I'm curious, through the chair, what is the difference between demand that you see from people who want to become a nurse and your capacity as a college? And also, what is the difference between your capacity as a college and demand out there among employers? Thank you.
Yeah, through the chair, that's a challenging scenario. One thing that's happening nationally right now is that there has been a dramatic decrease in student applications to nursing programs across the country. So when we hit last April or May, and we hit our deadline for applications for the fall, and we didn't have enough applications, viable applications, meaning students that met minimums, to fill all of our seats in Anchorage. We did elsewhere, but not in Anchorage. And that was the first time since, I believe, the 80s, since we've seen especially nationwide significant drop in applicants to nursing programs. And so we've done probably a half a dozen extra efforts, significant efforts, to try and increase our incoming cohort for this last fall. And we garnered a few, but we went with a couple seats that were unfilled. So when we look at if on that one page handout, you see that we've got anywhere at any one time between 400 and 600 pre-nursing majors. a lot of them stumble on anatomy and physiology, for example, or some of the prereq courses. And so we're trying to work across the campus and through Provost Runge also to help us try and figure out how to provide as much support as we can to the pre-nursing students, not just the students that get into the program. But so that's a big issue. We have capacity in our rural sites, although those saw a 25% increase in students this fall. So we were thrilled to see that, because when we go from 3 students in Bethel to 6 or 7 students in Bethel, that is extremely meaningful to that particular village and that particular community. So we were celebrating that one. But the decrease was just in the Anchorage area. And so we're working very diligently again to get the word out that there was some perception previously that don't even bother applying to the UAA program because you won't get in. And I see you shaking your head. That is a misnomer at this point in time, that's for sure. So we've spread the word loud and clear that now is the time to apply for anybody and everybody that wants to be a nurse, and we're ready to consider everything that we can to get you in the door at any one of our sites. Did that answer your question, Representative Fields?
Yes, it did. Thank you very much. Through the chair, a few years ago, there was a trend toward going to exclusively BSNs. And did that shift reduce the number of potential applicants? Should we be, you know, collectively reexamining that? Or is it the right decision to limit collegiate nurse training to BSNs as opposed to associates? Thank you.
Sure. Through the chair, we are focused on both. So we have almost all of our rural sites, or a majority of our rural sites, are AAS degrees. And so our BSNs right now are just in Fairbanks, Mat-Su Valley, Anchorage, and out in Kodiak. Everywhere else of our 15 sites are AAS degrees, and we're proud of that, and we're going to keep doing it. So the only place that we shifted away from the AAS was in Anchorage itself, and that was at the request of our industry partners that needed more BSN-trained nurses rather than AAS-trained RNs. And so so that's the shift we made just in the Anchorage area, but everywhere else we're still extremely focused and proud of our AAS degrees.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Brooks.
Thank you. I have a couple more fundamental questions. First one, where is Anchorage?
Everywhere.
No. Yeah, right. I've heard a little bit about the Fairbanks Hospital starting some sort of an internal nursing development program through the hospital, which sounds like a good idea to me, and it seems to be having some success. Is that happening other places? Are they interfacing with the university's nursing program, A? And B, does that sound like something that could be implemented more in the rural areas?
Certainly, through the chair. That's a challenging question because it depends on what level of nursing program they're wanting to offer and what our licensing board across the state will, for the various levels, will entertain. So CNA programs, certified nursing assistant programs, are taught in a variety of places, and from a lot of employers, they have their own CNA programs. And those folks are there to help nurses do their job, essentially. Our LPN program, I believe, is what Fairbanks is starting up. And we're working on a bridge program so that those LPN graduates, they're kind of the next level up from a CNA, but they don't have all of the training. They probably don't even have half of the training that a RN program has in an AAS degree. So their scope of practice is limited. And so we as in UAA College of Health and all of our nursing programs are staying away from developing the LPNs and leaving that up to the communities that may see a need for that. Historically, we've had LPN programs come in big favor in the, I believe, the mid to late 90s. And then that kind of faded away when everyone realized that their scope of practice was not close enough to RN to be of great value. And so and then the favor swung back to the RN. And now I think because of the shortage of RNs, we're seeing this, well, what else can we do? So we're seeing this kind of shift a little bit back toward the LPN programs. And Alaska's not alone in that. But in the College of Health, we're staying away from that because other people can offer it. And we'd like to continue to focus on our rather enormous nursing program for the RNs, producing RNs for the state. Did that answer your question?
I think so. Just to clarify, through the chair, is there a need for some adjusting in the licensing end of it? I'm thinking, and I don't have any experience in working in health fields, but there's a need. I can imagine there's a need for more training for somebody who's serving in a hospital or an emergency room or something like that. But then I would think that there would be less need for specialized training in things, elder care, other areas, and there could be more of a stepping, continuous learning and improvement program in the whole field. Is that kind of possible, or is there any need for adjusting, looking at the licensing requirements?
Yes, through the chair. I believe the current way that the licensing is set up in the states with CNA, LPN, RN, and then BSN, which is a bachelor's trained RN versus an AAS trained RN, and then into the graduate degrees also. And licensing takes care of all of that. And I honestly, my personal opinion is that they're doing a good job of it and they've got that under control. So I don't know that any of the licensing that happens in the state is a barrier to getting more nurses out at this moment in time.
So through the chair, then I would like to invite in now from our Kenai Peninsula College campus, Dr. Cheryl Steemers, who is the director there, to talk briefly about our resource industry programs.
Okay, yes, please. Thank you.
Thank you. For the record, this is Cheryl Steemers, director at Kenai Peninsula College at the University of Alaska Anchorage. Wanted to check and make sure my sound is okay.
We can hear you now. Yeah.
Wonderful. Kenai Peninsula College offers many different programs providing training and preparation for the process industry. This includes work on the North Slope, on oil rigs, in the seafood industry, in canneries, and more. Process technology, to kind of sum it up, is taking raw materials and refining and packaging them to produce a valuable product, valuable to our communities and very valuable to our state. Here at KPC, our emphasis is on the oil and gas industry, in which a majority of our nearly 1,000 graduates have found jobs. Our semester-long 1-year and 2-year certificates help place students in needed workforce opportunities across the state. And the good news here, enrollment is growing. This fall, we have 162 students enrolled in process tech programs at KPC. That brings me to my next point in the next slide. Welcoming these very students to the state-of-the-art facility we have here at KPC is one of our highlight experiences. Our Big Silver simulator, which you see in the photos here on screen, and I believe some of you may have visited in person, replicates the workforce experience and provides hands-on training. It's like a mini processing plant. It's actually a one-of-a-kind facility in the state. We tailor instruction to our working students, as many already hold jobs on the slope and elsewhere that require two-week-on, two-week-off schedules. So we offer lab intensives where students can fly in for training while conducting classwork and simulation activities online as well. Our process technology and instrumentation instructors come to the classroom with decades of industry experience to share with their students. Which brings me to our next point and our next slide, which is our workforce partners. KPC has developed an extremely close relationship with our industry partners Besides facilitating the recruitment of our students for both our internships and our permanent hires, these partnerships allow the industry to communicate to KPC the skills they are looking for. The open dialogue is facilitated each semester through our operators club and through our advisory board meetings. At the meetings, representatives from the major resource companies, such as Hillcore, ConocoPhillips, Marathon, many others, learn about our current curriculum, and they provide feedback for continuous program improvement. It also provides an opportunity for those many students to ask questions and learn about the hiring process at each company. Which brings me to my last and final point, and that's about our graduates and our placement. Graduates from process industry programs in Alaska are in very high demand. The data shown here comes from our 2023 UA Oil and Gas Workforce Report. Almost 90% of students are working in Alaska within 1 year of graduation at an average and I'd say very robust starting salary of about $80,000. These programs help boost the hiring rates of Alaskan residents and provide them with skills and training to join an industry with the potential for significant salary increases over the course of their careers. I'd conclude by saying our goal at KPC and UAA is to offer up-to-date training, state-of-the-art facilities, and robust partnerships that help meet critical workforce needs in our state. I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today, and I would be willing to answer questions.
Representative Fields. Thanks through the chair, Dr. Seamers. I was just curious of the process technician slots, how many of those are sponsored by the oil and gas companies versus how many are Alaskans who pay out of pocket hoping to get a job later? Thank you.
Most students that come to KPC will be Alaskans that pay out of pocket and hoping to get jobs later on. However, I would say we have had scholarships in the past from companies and support in a various myriad of ways.
If I could just ask a quick follow-up through the chair, what percentage of process technician program costs overall would you say are directly paid by industry right now? Thank you.
I would have to gather information then, but be happy to provide detail back to you.
Thank you. Representative Prox.
Yes, thank you through the chair. I need to correct the record a little bit. You said it was a one-of-a-kind facility, and there's another one in Fairbanks. That's north of where Anchorage, I believe, is between Kenai and Fairbanks. But and then I've worked, I know that because I worked to help set that up. And we were trying to work with the Kenai model. They got in at first. We were at the time supported largely by industry and good partnerships, both in oil and gas, actually electricity, and mining. Do you offer those type of courses as well? In those, well, process technology, we assumed it was the same thing pretty much for any industry. But do you include mining and electrical generation?
Thank you. Through the chair. Yes, we do stay in discussion with the UAF program. And are very supportive of both programs in the different areas. UAF does have a different emphasis area, and we do, KPC focuses primarily on oil and gas, not electricity, and some of the other areas that you mentioned.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose when I think about it, that makes sense. It was the opportunity of having those industries close to the campus. But the other, are you, and maybe to UAF and just every way in general, I think it's improving the communications between campuses, sharing knowledge, sharing, working together. Because it was a problem then. It was hard to find the university campus, or I guess really more the university main campus had a hard time finding Hutchison Career Center. Is that improving? This was 15 years ago.
Through the chair, if I may answer that, we have a number of things that the university system has put in place to ensure that we work together. So, for example, every single week, the vice president of academics and student affairs convenes the three provosts of the university, and we have a Zoom meeting to talk through issues and make sure we stay aligned. Director Seemers and the community campus directors from all of the campuses across the UA system meet regularly. They're called the Community Campus Directors Council. And so there's a lot of work now to make sure that we all stay aligned.
Yeah, that's glad to hear that. Thank you.
Thank you.
So through the chair, I'll continue ahead and try to wrap this up because I know we're running long. I just wanted to point out that UAA is about meeting students where they are in life. We're big on stackable credentials, credit for prior learning, which means if you've earned a certification in a number of areas, you can bring that certification to UAA, pay a very small fee, $25 a credit, and we will give you an appropriate course on your transcript for that. The other thing, particularly with Representative Fields here, I want to mention that in 2017, UAA became a federally recognized multi-occupation sponsor of apprenticeships. I personally worked on that along with some friends when I held an earlier position at UAA. And through that, we're able to work with small employers. We become the hirer, if you will, and we provide the related technical instruction, but the employer gets the immediate benefit of a well-trained student that they can continue to provide all of that hands-on component. And we've worked with a couple of different industries, and one of the most exciting ones that is developing now and very close to fruition is an apprenticeship in early childhood education that we hope you'll be hearing more about very soon. We're also a military-friendly school. We've had that designation for more than 15 years. We're growing our partnership with Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. But at the end of the day, we believe that college learning does not have to wait for college. So we're very heavily leaning into dual enrollment programs where students earn both high school and college credits simultaneously for the same course. This is efficient. It saves students and families money. It helps avoid debt. But it also helps out the schools in many ways to broaden their offerings. We have a lot of pathways where students can explore careers and accelerate their learning. And one of the most innovative, which began at UAA a number of years ago, as Representative Sadler reminded me, at our Chugiak Eagle River campus, the middle college program, which is now spread to UAF and to a number of other campuses. And that's where students attend more or less full-time on a university or community college campus while also completing their high school diploma. We had someone with us who has had to drop off, so I'm going to speak on behalf of Dr. Matthew Calhoun, who is the interim director, executive director of our Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, or ANSEP. Dr. Calhoun wanted to share that ANSEP is all about pathways for Alaskans, and particularly wanted me to show that since 1995, they've had a model that takes students from elementary school and supports them all the way through the doctorate. Dr. Calhoun and Michelle Yachmanif, who is shown here on this slide, are great examples of that. Dr. Yachmanif was the first Alaska Native ever to earn a PhD in engineering education, and she currently serves as the executive director of Alaska Native Education and Outreach for the university. But another great example, a current student, is Michael Martinez. Michael participated through early childhood programs with ANSEP, through the high school programs, on into the university programs, and now ANSEP is supporting him to complete his PhD, and we hope within a couple of years he'll become a university faculty member at one of our three universities. So as you can see, UAA is all about results. We have 70,000 alumni worldwide. Those alumni work in every single industry and in every community of Alaska. 25 members of the 33rd Alaska Legislature, including several in this room, thank you, attended or worked at UAA. And many of the rest of you have had family members go through UAA, your children, your spouses, your cousins. UAA alumni, we know, as are the alumni of UAF and UAS, more likely to stay in Alaska than those who go outside for education in another state. And at the end of the day, that's a workforce solution for Alaska. We believe we create opportunities, and we are really grateful for this time to share, but also for the ongoing support of the legislature. And I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Representative Fields.
Thank you, through the chair. I've certainly heard many positive things about the middle college from students who have participated in it. It does seem to improve access, affordability, and I would think from the college's perspective, completion rates. Could you help me understand how many students, in the practical manner, in ASD can participate in the middle college right now? How many cannot? And what is the potential for growth? And what limits the opportunity to expand the availability of that program? Thank you.
Through the chair, and particularly if we're going to focus in on the Anchorage School District, right now we've been averaging between 200 and 300 participants in the middle college program. It is available to all students. Currently, students need to be college ready either in writing or math. That is, they need to place into the college level course in either writing or math to participate. So that does, to some extent, limit the number of students who can participate. Another limiting factor is the social setting, right? Some families and students are ready to move on to college, but others would prefer to stay in their local high school, and we fully support them in that. I will say I serve currently on the steering committee of the Anchorage School District Academies model, and that is a really interesting opportunity for the future to bring more Anchorage School District students onto the UAA campus to take one or more college classes without having to leave their high school permanently and join the middle college high school. So we believe that both can exist simultaneously, and we're excited about that.
All right. Thank you. So I'd like to, seeing no other questions from the committee, I'd like to thank Provost Runge and all participants from UAA who took the time for this committee hearing, and thank you.
Thank you.
And we will take a brief at ease as we move into HB 146, Regulation of Fireworks. Okay, we are back on the record. Moving on to HB 146, Regulation of Fireworks, a bill by House Rules by request of the governor. We heard this bill last session, and we are going to have a brief refresher from Lloyd Nakano, Alaska State Fire Marshal. Please put your name on the record and proceed. Thank you.
Chair Sumner, Vice Chair Ruffage, members of the House in House Labor and Commerce Committee. Thank you for hearing House Bill 146, Regulation of Fireworks. For the record, my name is Lloyd Nakano, Director of the Department of Public Safety, Division of Fire and Life Safety, and I serve as a state fire marshal. In short, House Bill 146 moves the substantive rules relating to storage, sales, and use of fireworks in Alaska from statute to regulation, thereby allowing a more streamlined and responsive approach to the state's management of fireworks. The state's fireworks statutes have not changed in several decades. This bill will allow DPS to bring state rules in alignment with more modern approaches found in the International Fire Code, National Fire Protection Standards, Consumer Product Safety Commission standards as well. Under House Bill 146, DPS will be required to enact regulations establishing minimum standards for sale, storage, distribution, and use of fireworks. This bill will also permit DPS to establish fees for fireworks, firework permits, and inspections, and does authorize DPS to enter a building where fireworks are stored and kept. Under this subsection, DPS may not construe this to authorize to enter a private residence in which fireworks may be stored for personal use. And if you'd like to hear about the sectional analysis, we can also
good.
I believe we did that last year, yeah. So I think we're okay on that. Are there any questions? No. We also do have Robert Hall, owner of Gorilla Fireworks, online. I suppose to answer questions as somewhat of an industry expert. But any questions from the members? Representative Prox.
I'm actually more of just a comment, Mr. Chairman, through the chair. I've been paying a little bit more attention over the last 3 years to regulatory change notices that come out. And who is the person to talk to about the formatting and the information provided in the regulatory change notice process? I'm a little, there's room for improvement. This would be a good opportunity to look at that, and I am a little bit concerned. There's no point in me forwarding a regulatory change notice to someone in the public because there isn't enough information provided for them to understand what's going on, as compared to, for instance, a regulatory change notice in the Federal Register. You can, if you read a notice in the Federal Register, it's very thorough, what they're going to do, the statutes, a reference, et cetera, pages and pages and pages, but you get the idea. But in the state's regulatory notice process, the person receiving the notice has to go through a significant amount of work to figure out what's going on, and that is, frankly, irritating. So, anyway, I don't know. If comment on that, can you help me out?
Through the chair, Representative Prax, the regulation process is developed by the Department of Law Regulations Office. They can better provide you or answer your questions more specifically.
Close enough. Thank you.
Okay. Seeing no other questions, Vice Chair Ruffridge, do you have a motion?
Thank you, Chair Sumner. I would move House Bill 146, Version B, also referred to as 33-GH1356, /B, be advanced from committee with individual recommendations and the attached zero physical note.
Okay, without objection, House Bill 146 will be reported from committee. We'll take a brief at ease to sign the bill file. All right, we are back on the record. Last today on the agenda is HB 204, a bill by House Rules by request of the governor. This is a first bill hearing on HB 204. And I'd like to invite, I believe we have Jeremy Applegate and Kim Kolvig with the Department of Labor. You guys, you can go ahead and put your name on the record and begin your presentation.
For the record, my name is Jeremy Applegate, Investigator 5, Chief of Wage and Hour for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Chair Sumner, members of the committee, today I'm here to introduce House Bill 204, titled Overtime Pay Exemption, sponsored by the Honorable Governor Dunleavy. The purpose of this legislation is to add a section to Alaska Statute 2310.060, creating an exemption for overtime pay for full-time employees for up to 12 hours per day worked for some entities licensed under Alaska Statute 4732.010B. These entities include ambulatory surgical centers, child placement agencies, foster homes, freestanding birth centers, hospices, or agencies providing hospice services or operating hospice programs, nursing facilities, residential child care facilities, and residential psychiatric treatment centers. Currently, employees of ambulatory surgical centers and other health-related facilities are subject to state and federal overtime requirements. Under authority of Alaska Statute 2310.060A, employers may not employ an employee for a work week longer than 40 hours or for more than 8 hours in a day. Please note, a workday is a period of 24 contiguous hours as defined by the employer, and a work week is a period of 7 continuous work days, again, as defined by the employer. If an employer is found to have violated this part of the statute, they are required to pay a penalty to the employee known as overtime. This statute requires that all employees who are suffered or permitted to work by their employers be paid overtime compensation of 1.5 times their hourly rate of pay for hours worked in excess of 8 hours in a day. An employee is also entitled to overtime compensation for hours worked in excess of 40 hours in a week. Under Alaska Statute 2310-060D-14, state law provides some relief from this requirement if the employee voluntarily enters into a written agreement with the employer that is signed and filed with the department. This agreement is known as a flexible work hour plan or flex plan. The department issues a certificate approving the plan that states that work is for 40 hours a week and not more than 10 hours a day. For work over 40 hours a week or 10 hours a day, the employee is to be compensated at the rate of 1.5 times the regular rate of pay. In other words, they're to be paid overtime. Not only does state law make these requirements clear, but it is also should also be noted that the federal overtime standard is any work over 40 hours in a work week. In summary, if this legislation as written is passed into law, it would establish a new flex plan for businesses licensed under Alaska Statute 4732-01-B1, allowing for partial overtime exemption for the aforementioned entities. This frees them from the 10 hours currently allowed under the flex plan framework, allowing employees to work 12 hours under the exemption. And I'd be happy to take any questions you have.
Representative Sadler is first.
Thank you. Through the chair, real briefly, Mr. Applegate. So just to clarify, if an employee and employer sign and agree to a flexible work plan, they could work 10-hour shifts, 4 in a week, and not be subject to overtime. But if they were to work 5 10-hour shifts in a week, they would be subject to overtime for that extra 10 hours?
Through the chair, yes. Anything worked outside the plan would be paid as overtime.
Okay. Thanks.
Representative Fields.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, so am I correct in understanding that under current law, if a surgery center, say, wanted to pay someone for 3 12-hour days, they could do that, but they would have to pay overtime. Is that accurate?
Through the chair, that is accurate.
Okay. Through the chair, if I could just ask a follow-up. Have surgery centers, just to name an example, provided some evidence that they are financially constrained right now and unable to pay overtime to their employees?
I am unaware of any of their financial concerns. However, it has been expressed that it would benefit them in hiring and finding employees and offering working hours that would be suitable for those individuals.
Got it. If I could ask a follow-up. Conversely, through the chair, I'm curious if the department has modeled, you know, for a nurse who's working there, what would their reduction in pay be as a result of no longer being paid overtime under this hypothetical example where the employer no longer has to pay overtime? Just so we get a sense of the kind of cost shift from employee to employer.
Through the chair, I couldn't speak in real numbers. I don't have those. However, the simple answer is that any overtime that would have been worked on those days that would be specified in the plan would be offset as straight time rather than overtime. However, if the individual, as was previously indicated, if the individual worked outside that plan because there was a need for them to work further, overtime would still exist in those instances.
Thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, Mr. Applegate, just curious, in response to the previous question, there's the list of 20-some different employers who are exempt from the overtime. My question is a finding of the employer's financial condition an essential condition of whether they're exempt from overtime or not?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
Is any finding or determination of an employer's financial condition a determination fact, a determining factor as to whether or not their employees can be exempt from overtime? Does it matter?
Through the chair, no. Okay.
Representative Carrick.
Thank you, through the chair. I mean, going back to that question from Representative Fields, I would like to have a sense of how much overtime is costing facilities currently. This bill would apply to all facilities regardless of financial condition, but it would be a good context to understand maybe the scope of the challenge facilities are facing in this financial respect. Also, if we don't have the information now, I'd love to have follow-up on the average wage of people working in the professions listed under this legislation, just so we can get a sense of how much overtime pay is potentially a part of earned wages and what percentage of wages that accounts for, overtime pay versus the base salary.
So through the chair, that's not information that our office captures. However, we could probably get you in contact with an agency that may track those numbers.
Representative Prox.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I bet the answer is no, but does the department or has anybody tracked the cost of getting back and forth to work or going from one company, one employer that is limited now limits to 40 hours because of the overtime, and then having to travel and incur the necessary personal expenses to go take a second job? And there's two parts of it. One is typically it's 5 days to get 40 hours. This would make it possible to get the 40 hours in 4 days, which saves the going back and forth to work expense. Is that, has anybody thought of that?
Through the chair, I am unaware of anyone keeping those numbers.
Okay. Neither.
I actually believe that a 40-hour in 4 days is already possible under a flex plan, is it not? I don't know.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
Are companies in this industry already doing a 10-hour flex plan and then simply paying the 2 hours additional to have staff on for 12 hours? Or is this something that is not broadly occurring? And or do you guys have any data on that?
Yes, through the chair, yes. I can tell you from anecdotal evidence in processing work or flexible work and plans through our office that the 10-hour plans are widely used across a multitude of industries to include those listed in this bill. This would, again, free up or add to that availability to allow for those longer work days. And in addition to that, with regard to the 10-hour plans, they are to currently, under the current statutes and regulations regarding these flex plans, are to maintain the schedule that is identified and agreed to in the flex plans. If individuals work beyond the plan, it has to be due to circumstances essentially beyond the control of the employer. It's not that they get to schedule the employee for 40 hours and then additionally schedule them beyond the 10. It would only be incidental to employment where those overtime hours would become an acceptable thing. If the employees are made to work additional hours that are not incidental to employment, that would be a violation of the plan. If those violations go over 20% of the time that that plan is in place, the plan could be invalidated.
Representative Fields?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. That makes me wonder what the department could share with us. It's appropriate just to help get an understanding of how many businesses are using these 40-hour plans now and how many employees are affected. And I don't know if the department collects data on how many people are being paid overtime, but I just like to get a better sense of how this is being used right now and how it might change. Thank you.
Through the chair, I don't have those numbers right now, but I could get them for you as far as how many businesses, say, in the last several years have applied for flex plans. However, once they have an approved plan, that a plan can apply to any number of employees that would voluntarily enter. So if we send out a flex plan that has been approved to a business, they may put one employee on that plan. They may put 15 employees on that plan. So we would not be able to provide an accurate number with regard to that gradation.
Representative Carrick.
Thank you, through the chair. Just echoing the need for a lot more information, I guess, about the scope, which was my earlier comment. But in addition, I'm wondering if you have a comment from Department of Labor, and I'm not suggesting this, but at this point, but why is this legislation limited to these healthcare facilities when we know that there's such a huge use of overtime in a huge variety of professions and also for public employees with the very high vacancy factors we have across all of our departments? We use overtime very consistently in DOT, for example, to deal with things like the snowstorm we just had here in Juneau. In Fairbanks, we do all the time as well. So can you, do you have a comment on why this legislation is limited in scope to the individuals listed?
Through the chair, this industry has displayed a specific interest in this. I can't speak for other industries that may have an interest in a 12-hour plan. And I can say that hospitals, nursing, 12 hours is a standard shift in many of the healthcare industries we see. And so that would possibly correspond to the need within this industry or the request within this industry.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Applegate, through the chair. You know, in a lot of the precise language, it's kind of hard to lose. It's kind of easy to lose the real general understanding. So my clear question is, would this bill obligate an employee of a surgery center to work overtime, or would it leave it optional under a flexible work plan? Is it required them to work overtime?
Through the chair, it is the department's position that an employee serves at the employer's request. If the employee would like to opt out of working overtime, they are free to do so. However, there may be consequences to their not agreeing to do so. Under the flex plan, I would like to emphasize that entering into a flex plan is voluntary on behalf of the employee. They cannot be compelled. It cannot be made a condition of employment.
So again, to clarify, to get a straight answer, if I follow, so this does not obligate anybody to work overtime, correct?
Through the chair, correct.
Okay. But if they want to, if an employee voluntarily enters a flexible work plan with their employer, they can agree now to work 12 hours instead of 10 hours for the shift.
If this bill were implemented, yes, they could work 12 instead of 10.
So that, follow up again? So this just simply expands from 10 to 12 hours under a flexible work plan.
Through the chair, correct.
Thanks.
Representative Prux.
Yes, just thank you. Through the chair, just to clarify, this flexible arrangement is available, is it universally?
Through the chair, correct. Currently for 10 hours.
For 10 hours. Mm-hmm. That's good to know, because there just are lots of people working two jobs, and there's lots of employers that would essentially like to have the employer there for both jobs, and that's impossible to do. And it's a big deal for smaller companies, retail, small offices, et cetera. So I'll have to look into that some more. Thank you.
Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair Sumner. More just a comment and maybe a question there, but I felt like the committee discussion is focused in an area around either forcing an employee to work or taking away their opportunity to obtain overtime. I just wanted to say from a perspective in the medical industry, oftentimes your ability to hire an individual is based on your ability to pay a 12-hour workday, and oftentimes the decision will be made if you will be charged overtime in order to hire the person at the shift that they would like to work, which in many cases is 12 hours. As an employer making the cost-conscious decision, you may not hire an individual or cannot hire an individual if the flex plan is only available at 10 hours. And so I think in the interest of trying to understand the bill for myself, I got the sense that for these limited places, this may help the ability of these places to fill otherwise vacant positions because people are looking for 12-hour shifts. Is that Is that, in your opinion, the purpose behind this bill?
Through the chair, the name Flexible Work Hour Plan is accurate. It does provide flexibility to the employees that does not exist when the Flexible Work Hour Plan is not implemented.
Okay, and just to follow up to that, if I may, you had made a statement earlier regarding the reason why it was limited to these certain entities and that there was a request made. Was that the reason for the request, was the inability to hire people who wished to have a 12-hour workday?
Through the chair, I don't have an answer to that question. I do not know. It would only be speculative on my part.
Representative Fields.
Thanks, through the chair. I don't expect the Department of Labor to have this data, but I would like to see the most recent data on reimbursement rates for orthopedic procedures in Alaska compared to other states. I know that for much of the last 25 years, we've seen very high growth in orthopedic rates here in Alaska, so it's certainly my impression that the freestanding surgeries are actually centers are extremely profitable. In that case, I don't know why they couldn't pay overtime right now. There are a lot of facilities covered by this bill. So I think one thing I'm going to be interested in is, I think orthopedic reimbursement rates can help us understand the ambulatory surgery centers. That's a very different economic picture from, say, an intermediate care facility for individuals with intellectual disabilities. I actually don't know which those facilities are. I'd like to learn more about them. I assume residential psychiatric treatment centers refers to North Star Behavioral Health. I'd like to learn more publicly available information. What are we paying per person to house someone at North Star each day? I assume the agency understands the profit margin that company is receiving. Is it reasonable to take away overtime, pay for a nurse? So I think a little more granularity in each of these categories would be helpful in me deciding, is it fair to take away overtime pay from an employee of each of those facilities? Thank you.
Representative Fox.
He's an organizer.
Am I understanding that we're taking away something or providing an option for something else?
Through the chair, I believe the second is correct, that because it is voluntary on behalf of the employee, you're not taking away their overtime. You're allowing them the opportunity to have a more flexible schedule by trading out the availability of overtime later in the week.
Thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. I want to clarify this in my mind through the chair, Mr. Applegate. Does the department offer information to the legislature on the profitability of companies in Alaska? Is that information available to us?
Through the chair, that is outside of my area of expertise. Wage and hour would not be keeping those numbers.
But if we wanted to spend time on trying to calculate it, we could extrapolate information on our own.
No.
Through the chair, possibly. I don't know.
Thank you.
Just through the chair, to clarify my request, if Mr. Applegate is sort of the administration's point person on this, I guess what I was suggesting is perhaps he might be able to collaborate with some other departments just to get information that would be relevant for our decisions. Thank you. I know it's not in wage and hour.
Through the chair, as stated earlier, we can probably get you in contact with people that may have some of the numbers that you're looking for.
Thank you.
I don't know that profitability data is available. I mean, we don't have broad income taxes. But certainly, I would like to see the Department of Labor or whatever department might have. I mean, I would assume Department of Labor provide some overtime data for these industries, certainly. So I think seeing no other questions, that concludes our business today. We will set this bill aside. And committee will adjourn. Let the record reflect the time is 4:42 p.m.